The next issue is in agenda paper 8F. It covers the issues on accounting for income tax. Both the IFRS for SMEs and full IFRS follow a temporary difference approach. However, some of the requirements in the IFRS for SMEs differ from full IFRS because it is based on the 2009 exposure draft, which was intended at the time to result in a simplified replacement of IAS 12. Of all the sections of the IFRS for SMEs, section 29 on income tax is probably the one that we hear we get the most feedback that it's too complex and causing problems for SMEs, and that this is one area where the ISB could provide some relief for SMEs. The first question to the ISB is, do we still think the temporary difference method is the right approach for SMEs?
I think on basis of simplicity.
But the staff is proposing a change, right?
Yes, I've got to it was just to get an overall feeling of whether people were supportive of a temporary difference approach, say in line with full IFRS, or whether people felt that SMEs should be following a more simplified basis.
I think we should have a more complicated method.
I think we have.
I think we should stick with what we've got.
Not that complicated. I think to go for a too simple model will give actually some people lack of signals of problems they can have ahead of them. So even if it's a complicated model, I think it's a good model.
Gary?
I don't think the temporary difference method is any more complicated than the timing difference method. I've lived in both regimes. They each have their complexities. They each have their pluses. And on balance, I think the temporary different method is relatively simple. Where the complications come in is when you've got the pre-tax items and OCI or deferred. I think it's not so much the tax accounting that's difficult. It's the accounting for the other stuff. You know, the translation and other deferrals, the taxes, I think it's generally manageable.
So no appetite for change?
As the staff explained it in the paper, maybe I didn't understand it, the current provisions on income taxes in the SME guidance is based on an exposure draft that wasn't finalized but was intended to simplify IAS 12. And people are complaining that it's too complicated. So we're saying, okay, follow 12, which doesn't seem to make sense to me.
People are complaining that the overall temporary difference approach is too complex. So it's not just the difference between IAS 12 and the current standard. We're hearing two things. We're hearing that really they would prefer IAS 12 than what we've got, but also we've got some SMEs are not familiar with a temporary difference approach altogether, and so that they would prefer not to an alignment with IAS 12 but something simpler.
And just in my experience, unlike Gary's, where I found people having difficulty with 12, particularly people that are not tax experts, which presumably SME management or not, have difficulty with this notion that somehow there's a tax basis to assets and liabilities in jurisdictions that don't have that concept. So I don't know whether to support the staff recommendation or not. I'm confused.
PK?
You know, I supported staff's recommendation. One reason for that is that tax accounting as such is a complicated accounting. If we have two different types of regimes in the same area, you will have difficulty attracting the talent. See, suppose I know tax accounting. Let's assume that for a second. I will have to turn the pages to see what is applicable to SME, and if I'm doing for the IFRS 12 also, for IFRS entities, full IFRS entities. I think the pool of talent you will reduce if you keep this. So that's one of the reasons for me to do that. And the other reason is that the exposure draft had a lot of issues that we have encountered. And one of the reasons why we did not carry forward with the exposure draft is the number of questions outweighed the number of lines we had in the exposure draft. So we felt that it is not good to do that. And so we're laying that on the SMEs where the expertise can be a little bit more challenging. I think it would be unduly burdensome to them. So that's one of the reasons I said, yeah, it could be retrograde, but it's better retrograde than. So I don't agree with that.
There's nothing unusual in that.
But I agree also with PK, because Isaac Manz's more deeper text stuff is very complicated, and even if you have temporary method, I think it's also complicated. And I would assume that many companies using maybe their tax advisor to doing these calculations and then to align it more with IAS 12 is, I see some benefits into that. I see some benefits into that because it is easier to get really people who really know IAS 12, but temporary difference model, I think, is at least what I know is not that many.
Staff recommendation?
Just to check what part of the staff recommendation are we talking? I think I've probably confused matters. I've probably confused matters by putting four questions in. But I think the first one was more what was the overall approach? Were people still comfortable with a temporary different approach? The second was, if so, should we align with IS 12?
Yes.
And then the next question on top of that is, would we consider any further simplification? Because we have in some sections got followed an IS 12 approach, but say taken some requirements in the section, and we've got, say, an undue cost or effort exemption from applying certain requirements. Like for a defined benefit plan, we've got an exemption for use of the projected unit credit method for undue cost or effort.
I think it's yes to all. And for the third portion of your question, like if you want to do any specific exemptions, when you look at it, when you bring it back to the board, that's when we decide. You know, on principle, yes, we need to look at it. If there are some simplifications we can do, we should do it. And I think that's the idea. So that's why it's yes to all.
I assume that was the...
Well, I think yes to one and two. Can I just confirm the undue... Now, I might be muddled up. I'm looking at the questions for the ISB. Mm-hmm. The third question, which asks whether you have an undue cost or effort exemption.
PK is saying yes and yes.
Are you saying yes to an undue cost exemption?
But what does that mean? I think that is what PK says.
That means that if it's too hard to do, then you can bring do it cash back, accounting.
You bring it back, that's when we discuss. At this point in time, it's difficult to say. You cannot have undue cost exemption. It would be foolish at this stage to say. We should charge the SME group to run with it, see what is the thing that you're going to bring it back, and the board will decide whether that is right or wrong. I don't think we can say no at this stage.
I think what the recommendation from the SMIG group was in line with 1 and 2, so yes with temporary difference, yes with aligning with IS 12, which I think is what a lot of the discussion was about here. But then it was only a small minority that felt an undue cost or effort exemption made sense. They felt that you needed to make the best effort to get to the right answer.
Think about business combination, why we want to have no goodwill impairment but do goodwill amortization, undue cost, right, for doing it. Why did we do pensions once in 3 years? You have to get a thing, undue cost. So we have done that enough number of times in the SME standards. I would keep the same logic.
Right, but if you have really huge deferred tax liabilities, you cannot say, okay, it's too hard to calculate that, and therefore I think it depends on what we mean by that, right?
So my inclination, to be honest, is to say no here. And I just feel because at the end of the day, this is a balance sheet item we're calculating. It's an important balance sheet item. If we're going to do it, I think it needs to be consistently applied. And I'm concerned that in something like deferred tax, it might be too easy
to fall into the undue cost and effort argument and just not actually report it.
So are you blanketly giving the undue cost to the preparer or undue cost to the SMIG group to come up with it?
No, so what the SMIG said, the SMIG view was they would prefer, I think, am I correct in saying, the SMIG view, a minority supported the undue cost and effort, but the majority didn't.
It would
want
answer
that
no
in.
To question
so
three.
No to
I know,
question
I understand,
three.
But if it is for the to develop the standard, then I can say we should put it. But for giving the preparers the carte blanche, don't do it if it is undue cost, then I will say no. So to whom does this question is charged to? If it is to the to developing the standard, yes, I will say yes to that. If it's, I will say undue cost, don't do it to preparers. If I put that in the standard, then I will not have that.
Okay, then I think the answer you're getting to is no.
If it's to the preparers, yes.
yes, no.
Michelle, I'm understanding correctly the question here. The question
yeah.
was, should we put the exemption into the standard? In other words, allow preparers the option of say, not the option, allow preparers to apply an undue cost or effort test to whether they apply a deferred tax approach.
Well, I think that the staff left it open just to see if there was any, well, the board's feeling on whether the staff should go away and develop, because I understand, my understanding is that the board want the Section 29 to be aligned with IS 12, but then it's whether the board can give the staff any guidance or whether it's worth the staff going away and looking at ways to incorporate undue cost or effort, whether or not it's an overall undue cost or effort or whether it's for specific requirements. But I don't know if there's board members are very anti putting any undue cost or effort in there. It's probably not worth going away and developing something, but maybe...
No, what I'm hearing is you don't want to give the preparers that option, and that's the issue. And IFRS 1 is the same. Yeah, and I think if I'm right in saying in SMEs today, every cost and undue cost or effort exemption is one where you've decided don't do that because we think there's undue cost or effort.
Exactly.
And so you're not giving preparers, and I think you do just ask for guidance, are there some aspects of IS 12 that you think we should apply that to? In
exactly.
other words, take those out because of that reason. But I don't think you're for one moment suggesting we put it in as a for the preparers to decide at their discretion.
Yep. But I think, in fact, that's exactly what, certainly in the discussion that we had at SMIG, there are one or two circumstances in the SME standard at the moment, for example, fair value of investment property, where we allow a preparer not to go with fair value if it takes undue cost or effort.
Okay,
so we actually allow the exemption. Now, there's two things that I'm getting out of, that I'm hearing out of this, and then PK, you can tell me if I'm. The first one is that we shouldn't be taking IS 12 and sticking it straight into
exactly.
Yeah, we should be simplifying it, and that's one way of answering three. It needs to be a simplified version of IS 12. But the other side, I don't think you were supporting that simplified version having an override for undue cost and effort.
Yeah, I'd read it too quickly.
No, I think I also might have got confused.
But I read it too quickly. My view is that when you SMIG and you guys go away to draft IS 12 to apply to replace the existing 29, you're going to take undue cost into mind, which Alan is expanding on it. Come back to us and say what you think is the undue cost you feel, and we will decide, but we will not put that in the standard.
So no exemption in the standard, but obviously to look at ways to simplify as we've
exactly.
done.
Exactly.
Okay, we still agree?
Yes.
Mm-hmm. All right.
Question four is, in December 2010, the ISB amended IS 12 to introduce a rebuttable presumption that investment property measured at fair value will be recovered through sale. This is another new and revised IFRS issued since the IFRS was published. However, the staff is recommending introducing this into the standard because it's already effective. We've got implementation experience because a number of entities have adopted it early, and that it results in a simplification of current requirements. And also now, if we're going to be aligning Section 29 with IS 12, it would make sense to incorporate that at this time.
Yes.
Vote.
Yeah, no, we agree, I think.
So 16, nobody objects, is that right?
Correct.
16-0.
The next stage of communism is that you don't vote at all anymore.
Okay,
but there is no dictator here, right? Hans, nobody's trying to be a dictator here, right?
Leadership of the board as a whole.
Democratically republic.
Okay.
So moving on to agenda paper 8G. The first issue relates to the amortization period for goodwill and other intangible assets. Currently, the IFRS for SMEs requires if an entity is unable to make a reliable estimate of the useful life, it's presumed to be a fixed life of 10 years. However, we've been told, firstly, in some cases, that even though a reliable estimate can't be made, it's clear that 10 years may be too long. Also, we've heard that the fixed life causes a problem in some jurisdictions, that as the laws may require a different default life, for example, 5 years. The SME Implementation Group have recommended alternative wording for the ISB to consider. And this is in the box just before paragraph 9. And that's if an entity is unable to make a reliable estimate of the life, it shall be determined based on management's best estimate and shall not exceed 5 years. The staff generally support this but suggest retaining 10 years so there would be less, the entities would have to make less adjustments to the financial statements for that. But under the proposal, basically the change would be instead of having a fixed 10-year life, the 10-year instead would be an upper limit when you can't make a reliable estimate. So do the ISB agree with modifying 8.20 as suggested by the staff or by the SME Implementation Group?
Ask a question that I was struggling with. Why do we think that if you can't make a reliable estimate, you can make a best estimate? it seems to me to be sending a confusing signal to people.
Yes.
If you conclude you can't make a reliable estimate, somehow we think you still can make a best estimate, and I'm maybe not getting the difference.
I think the concern was the way it was originally worded. You would have a fairly short-dated intangible. You might not be able to say how many years, but you know it's 3 or 4 or 5 years. The standard previously forced you to take 10 years, though your inherent gut feel about it, the best feel you had, so you didn't have an auditable number. You couldn't prove that it was 5 years or 6 years or 4 years. But the standard was then forcing you in that circumstance to go for 10 years. This allows you to say, well, if you don't have a number that is auditable, but you still have a fairly good feel for it, go with that lower number, as long as it doesn't exceed 10 years.
It's the best unreliable number.
Yeah, that's what it amounts to. It's the best unreliable number is still better than the wrong number.
Yeah.
It wasn't a concern about
remember
the year thing.
Talk about fair value.
It didn't feel like it was helping people.
So, and you're right. I think the wording is going to be a challenge here, but.
It's the same question about wording. I mean, I agree that if you don't have a reliable estimate, maybe to force 10 years and only 10 years, not 9 or 11, might not be the best answer. But this notion of best versus reliable, also, I'm not comfortable with that. I think it should be a policy election and don't have to say it's the best estimate because you don't have a reliable estimate. So how can it be best? It's just a policy election not to exceed 10 years.
Yes, yes.
I think a lot of the discussion we just had about best versus reliable was one of the reasons why the SMIG decided to reduce it from 10 years to 5 years. Because the feeling on the SMIG view was that if you were going to have a number that was, rather make it a shorter number than a longer number.
Okay, well, otherwise, the staff will have to look at the wording, but can we agree with the overall conclusion?
I thought we were not voting.
That is Staff's.
Okay.
Yes.
I think that's the same. Okay.
The next issue in agenda paper 8G, it starts on page 6. It relates to the presentation of the share subscription receivable. The IFRS for SMEs currently requires them to be offset against equity. However, there are mixed views from respondents on whether the receivable should be presented as an asset or adjustment to equity. Also, some national laws require presentation as an asset. Now, the requirement in the IFRS for SMEs was added as additional guidance, whereas full IFRS is silent. So the question to the ISB is whether paragraph 22.7a should be amended or deleted. And the staff are suggesting that it should be deleted.
This is the only issue among this group of issues I feel strongly about. And the reason is because if you're going to present a set of financial statements like this to a prospective lender or investor, presenting a balance sheet that illustrates a certain equity base that doesn't exist because the cash is not in the bank is extremely misleading. So this is where games can really be played in a small and medium-sized business. I would not entertain this change at all. To me, this is the cornerstone of these types of entities. They have difficulty raising capital. A lot of it is self-generated. So if they can play this game, hope and wish accounting, in my view, then you're opening Pandora's box.
You don't understand the system. It's not hope and wish. You have issued capital. Just it's not yet paid. But you have a legal decision, an AGM, and the share issue has been done. It's just yet it's a receivable.
The paper has been exchanged, you're right, but the cash
has
not.
Exchanged. The new shares have been...
That's what I mean. They've been issued, but the cash is not in the bank.
True, but receivable, well, I mean, revenue recognition, you don't have the cash in the box. If you want to go back to cash accounting, fine, but we are not on a cash basis accounting. And what the point you make is important.
I'm not recommending going to a cash basis accounting.
No, but the argument is that the cash is not at the bank. It's like a trade receivable. But where you are right is that there is a risk that this kind of receivable is not the same as a receivable on a trade customer. So there should be a proper disclosure. If we allow this asset to be shown to reflect the shares issued and not paid, there should be a strong disclosure that it is a receivable on shareholders, which is not the same credit risk, maybe better, I don't know, or lower than the trade receivables. But you have to be aware that this difference that we have here is one of the conflicts with the fourth directive. It's one of the reasons why the European Commission said, IFRS for SME is not compatible. Here, by doing what the staff is proposing, we would eliminate one of the conflicts with the directives. And I don't think it is hope and wish accounting. You have a management decision, a shareholder decision, an AGM decision, which is formally there to issue shares. There is a timing difference in the receipt of cash. But it's a true receivable.
PK.
Michel, as you know, I said to you at the beginning of this, our discussions, I told you privately that the only issue that I am opposed to your recommendation is this particular one. I think there are two reasons for that. One is that the major book, or the red book, is silent. But I would think that if you poll notwithstanding what Philip just said, but if you poll most people, they will say that showing a receivable for a share subscription as an asset would be against many people's, many jurisdictions' accounting answer. Not only that, in the recent conceptual framework discussion, one of the ideas that Peter was brought up and he had shown an asset in particular accounting. And when we asked him back, he said, I'm not saying that's the right answer, and he doesn't think so. And he said he'll come back and discuss it. So even conceptual framework, we are thinking that we will not allow. The reason why this was put is to bring certain amount of consistency across, and to some of the points that Pat Finnegan raised are relevant to it. And the board at that time felt very comfortable to make this decision. And I think at this point in time, by removing it, we are silently telling you can do an asset. And I don't know whether that is the right answer. And I think having been there, I wouldn't change it at this point in time. Okay, if you're silent all along, okay, that's a different issue. But you're giving permission to show it as an asset.
Patricia?
I agree with Pat and PK, unless the staff has additional background beyond what PK has about why this got into the original standard in the first place.
It's mainly that because some laws require it to be presented as an asset. I believe it was also a difference between the IFRS for SMEs and EU directives.
It didn't putting it in make the difference with the directive?
Yeah, that's what FIFA said.
Yeah, so I wondered why they felt so strongly to put it in, knowing that it went against the directive. That was my question.
I'm not sure. I'll have to have a look back
at discussions. I wouldn't be worried.
But it's a bigger question on national law or European directives. Should we be amending our standards to meet directives as a general principle?
No, you should not.
Should we create conflicts without having a very strong reason to create
conflicts? Let's not create unnecessary conflicts.
But that's why I asked what the reason was for having created the conflict in the first place.
I'd imagine because they thought it was the right accounting treatment.
Yeah, I think it was just to provide guidance and as a simplification, but I'm not sure if there was any other further thought behind it.
I don't remember the discussion because only five of us are left from that era in this board today. I don't think any major discussion. I think it was almost an unanimous vote. I can't recollect it, but I remember only five of us are there from that time, and it's an unanimous vote.
What's the majority of practice under full IFRS for this?
I'm not sure.
It depends, because you have in the separate accounts, which are more or less on IFRS, but not fully because we don't cover. Most companies will follow the legal rule and record a receivable, but maybe not in consolidation because they feel less comfortable in the consolidated accounts. We're silent, but framework, etc., says maybe it's not an asset. So they don't do it in consolidation.
That's the recommendation from the firms. Is it in their big books?
I think so.
But I think the practice is if the legal rules which drive the separate accounts do require, as is European legislation, that you have a receivable, they will keep it in the separate accounts. Maybe they are not under IFRS, but it's a practice. But not in consolidation, though.
Philippe, the scenario you described, as I understand correctly, already finished all the legal procedure.
Yep.
Yeah, I will support.
There is an AGM decision. The shareholders have to pay. If they don't pay, they don't get their shares.
All the procedures. Then I will support
the legal right to the cash.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yes. It's enforceable. Yeah. Unless the shareholder defaults. It's enforceable by the entity. It can go to court to get the cash. It's quite different from hope and wish. Hope and wish, I may issue shares. I may have a management decision, but the AGM has not acted on it. So it's not enforceable. That's what I think Patrick is worried about that. And I think if you follow the legal system, at least the one I know, which is the very strict European legal system, it is a true receivable enforced that you can enforce. It may not be true everywhere. That's a problem. And it's a legal issue. So I can understand that. But I mean, to force it might be difficult.
It suggests that even if we went this route that's recommended here, we would need, because I think the SMIG wanted us to have additional guidance here. The guidance would need to make it very clear that it has to be legally enforceable right to the cash.
Yeah. Okay, who can support the staff's recommendation?
Eight.
That's not enough.
The keyboard is in there.
Sorry. Don't you have a double vote in this case? Mm-hmm. You don't have a double vote when there is working on?
We need two more.
Now one more.
One more.
Two. No, it's two. It's ten.
Oh, only ten.
It's
yeah.
A supermajority for all SMEs.
But what? For all board votes, is it?
For the SME. No, not for the board votes. It's only, it's clear it's only once you get a balloting. So if something was like this at 8-all and you happen to put in the change, there's nothing stopping people. You'd have to think about dissenting. We'd need, if seven people dissented to that one change, then we'd lose it. So the question is whether you dissent to a change.
So we
as well.
Needed only one vote. More.
No.
Still two. Two.
Well, that presumes that people that voted against it would also dissent, which is not necessarily the case. So the rules are different.
Yeah. But we're having a discussion on what the board feels about it.
Yeah, but then I think a normal majority.
What I'm saying is that board votes don't have to always be 10 from now on.
No.
For something to be agreed in this meeting, we need 9.
Yeah.
But to go to an exposure draft where the board is divided, can't we ask a question?
Yep. I'm not talking about this particular issue. I'm just questioning the assumption that it seems to be that we always need 10 votes in a board meeting, which we don't.
The only reason, if we don't get the 10, then you have reason to pause and ask whether or not.
Yeah, sure. If it's a split vote, then clearly we have to pause.
But here we are. We have a completely split vote, so no decision.
Should ask the question.
But that stays as it is.
And, yeah, exactly.
And the question can be asked.
Yeah. I feel very interesting, you know. In many cases, you know, if the shareholders passed resolutions or the board director passed resolutions, we can consider as a basis to recognize something. But in this case, you know, they have already gone through all the procedures. I feel hard, you know. As I understand, there are two basic corporate law systems. One group of countries use the so-called radius capital systems. You have to follow all the procedures. And already follow all the procedures, and why, you know, we shouldn't require them to recognize.
Well, a lot of questions have been asked also that were not all answered. For example, why was this put in to begin with? So I recommend that Michel takes back this issue to SMEG and see if we missed any arguments and if you. Okay.
Well, it's probably the original debate by the board that I think
the original debate, and then I think Steve's question about how often it actually becomes an asset in full IFRS, how often it achieves an asset in full IFRS, I think.
May I ask it this question also? Typically, you know, in the audit world, the easiest way to test whether or not a receivable is valid as of a certain date is to find out whether it was collected within a period of time before the financial statements are issued. That's what auditors do. So the question I guess I have in mind is whether or not there was any board discussion around permitting that presentation, assuming that before the financial statements were issued, there was evidence that the cash was collected, the promissory note in theory was given.
It doesn't work that way. The delay over which this share should be paid in cash depends on the legislation. And you cannot postpone the approval or the auditing of the accounts just to wait and see until the end.
I'm not suggesting they are. I'm just saying that when the decision is made to issue the financial statements.
Let's assume.
Was it collected?
We assume my law says you have 1 year to pay. 1 year.
Are we which is not uncommon.
To say the auditor will issue the report only after 1 year because just to see whether it's been paid? No. It has to issue the report in 2 or 3 months. And given no, it's not yet paid. It's still payable.
If the guy has money. You don't know if the guy has the money. Perhaps you have arranged someone to stand up and say, yes, I will sign up for $100 million. He has nothing.
Well, then he has a problem because he will be...
Of course he has.
He will be taken to court to pay.
By whom?
We don't order order. We don't have a clear conclusion. So I would try and find out if we missed any arguments. If you feel there's a reason that you might want to present it again, then.
In the same vein, I will go back to the 1.5.
But you know, there is a lot of skepticism.
The same vein, if you are going to bring this issue back because we didn't get enough votes, I will go back in 1.5 and bring the same issue back.
Are you threatening us?
If you are bringing, we got to respect the board vote, and in the first issue at 1.5.
We didn't have 8 all in the 1.5.
Yeah, but we had 7 though. It was that close. Mm. So you can argue that way. 7 and 9, it's not a big difference.
Michelle knows that there is a lot of skepticism around the board.
Yeah. Thank you.
Better be brought back only if there is any fear.
I was just going to say, if the next time we see this is actually only in a draft, in an exposure draft, to not just plan on asking the question, but to include, either the language that Wei Guo, for example, was speaking about in terms of in those situations in which it's been fully approved, so that people have a sense of what the tipping point is, not just a general open question. That's assuming it doesn't come back separate from.
Okay.
Okay. Thank you.
One more question.
The next issue starts on page 9, and it's about the inclusion of additional topics in the IFRS for SMEs. The staff have listed the suggestions made by two or more comment letters in paragraph 16. It's really whether or not the ISB think these or any other topics should be specifically addressed in the IFRS for SMEs. The staff isn't recommending any additions.
And are you telling us that there were very few letters suggesting this? You say two or more, but
yeah,
more might be 200 or 300. Is it just a few or is it a lot?
Just a few, yeah. So there weren't many.
I just have one, though. You know, when you fall back to IAS 39, I forgot how we dealt with that, the own credit issue, whether the own credit, will that be something we need to take care here? Because I don't know how we took care of own credit to OCI in the full IFRS, and I forgot whether we have gone and changed 39 or we put it in 9, and we told people that even if you don't adopt anything else, you can adopt only that piece. So make sure that you bring that into IAS 39 somehow for these people. You follow me, right?
Yes. I'll have to go back and look at what it's...
That's the only thing I thought when you said, is there anything else? That's own credit is the only issue I thought of.
Mm-hmm. It's a big issue to have the own liabilities at fair value for SMEs.
Look, we are not here for own thing because we put IAS 39. We told people to fall back to IAS 39.
Okay, then you will bring the own credit if they fall back.
Yeah, if they fall
back. All right, okay.
There's an element of circularity here, though, because you're unlikely to have significant fair value movements in your own credit if you don't have listed own credit. If you've got listed own credit, you're not going to be in the standard in the first place. Yeah.
But somebody can bring it up. I just wanted to...
I think it's definitely worth us having a think outside of...
You can follow the staff's recommendation.
Yes.
The next issue is on Q&As, and it starts on page 12 of Agenda Paper HE. We asked a question in the request for information because although we've received a lot of positive feedback on Q&As, we've also heard some negative feedback as well. For example, some people think that they add another set of rules on top of the IFRS for SMEs and others that they can create conflict with full IFRS, for example, where we're dealing with issues that are also issues under full IFRS. So the first question to the ISB is whether you think that the Q&A program should continue after this comprehensive review is completed.
Again, it's a question for information because when I was reading through what was suggested in terms of continuing the Q&A, it sounded to me like the SME implementation group would stop running Q&As. Fewer would come up and the board, we would do them ourselves directly, and more of what the SME implementation group had done would go to educational material. Is that a correct understanding, or is it actually more like, say, the SME implementation group really running the Q&As and then forwarding to the board for issuance the way we do AIP?
Well, that's actually part of the next question, but we could deal with the two.
Well, it interacts. I put them together because I think it's a question of whether it's, in exceptional cases, there'll be full due process around very few Q&As, just so we have that outlet if necessary, versus what started off as pretty ambitious to issue a large volume of guidance in the form of Q&As that wasn't characterized as educational material. So my answer to the first question depends on having some kind of vision of what the Q&A...
What the staff are and the SME implementation group are proposing is we've had a lot of feedback from, on the request for information and also outside the request for information that the Q&As don't go through adequate due process for documents issued under the control of the board. Some respondents think they should go through the same due process as interpretations. Currently, what the Q&As require is, it's been set out in the paper, is a sort of a negative approval process for all board members see it, and it's if three board members reject it, then the Q&A will be rejected. But the staff are wondering whether the reason people are reviewing the Q&As like interpretations is perhaps because the due process is too much for non-mandatory guidance. What the staff see these Q&As as more like educational in nature rather than like interpretations. So the staff are wondering whether it would be better if, well, the staff in the SMEG suggested a two-tier approach for Q&As, where the tier one would be rarer cases, and they would require full due process, and they would be authoritative guidance, so they would come for the full board approval in the same way as the interpretations, and whether tier two, which would be the norm, which would be just requiring SME implementation group approval and maybe just feedback from board members on those.
Let's try to keep that possible.
And tier two would then go out as educational material rather than Q&A that supplement.
Yes, and with the view of them being educational material, maybe people would see them. Because at the moment, the problem is people saying that then don't go through adequate due process, but that could be because we've got a halfway house.
Yeah.
Part of the problem becomes a stable platform, because if you start to see the Q&As like you would interpretations, then it means that actually you don't have a stable platform. Every time there's a Q&A, you need to revisit to see whether that changes your application. If it's pure educational material, what we're doing is we're actually downgrading the quality, or the downgrading the... hierarchy of it. And by doing that, it means that actually you can continue practicing without constantly referring to whether or not there's a new one out there. And I think that's what this was trying to achieve.
Well, and that's why I was asking what exactly we were thinking about, because it's hard for me to answer, should we keep Q&As? As if it's on the basis of the current process, I would say no, but there seemed to be something else coming here. Yeah. I couldn't tell if it was really a change or if it was just a who's signing off.
But it still accepts the fact, the two-tier process, that there might actually be times when we need to change the underlying meaning of something we've said, and hence the two tiers. Hopefully, almost never.
Yeah.
So Amar? I think the two-tier system is working well. Prove it in the last 3 years. I have only one question on the due process, just clarification to understand. On item 25 and 20 and 3rd, we mentioned that the Q&A is released for public comment unless 4 or more ISB members. So it's, we'll keep 4, or are we going to, because this was probably approved back when we were a smaller board, so it's just, is this in line with the what is Alan bringing to us about voting system?
Should it become 5?
No, we still have 4 now for interpretations, so we haven't changed it at all, knowing that we're actually going up to 16, so it wouldn't be, I don't think it would be consistent to actually change that level.
So you don't foresee the need for us to change this, right?
No.
Darren mentioned interpretation, the word interpretations that we did not discuss this morning. We considered this morning the new IFRS and whether some of those should be brought into the IFRS for SMEs, but we were silent on considering the possible impact of interpretations developed by IFRIC since 2009 and whether some of or any of those should be considered for the IFRS for SMEs. Was it on purpose or was it on omission from your side? And I think, at least formally, we should say that we do not consider any of the IFRIC interpretations issued since 2009 to be worth being incorporated in some form into IFRS for SMEs. But just to ignore all the work done by IFRIC at the time we revised, IFRS for SMEs would be seen as an omission by many.
We didn't intend to ignore them. We were just bringing the 5 that we thought were would propose the most significant changes based on what's in the SME standard at the moment. But we did say in the paper that we'll be bringing the others to future meetings.
All right.
It is to get a feeling of the board's sentiment on those first and then.
Okay,
the
so you
will.
plan to have us deliberate on whether or not any interpretation should be considered. Okay.
Patricia?
It's unclear to me what effect this decision will have on existing Q&As.
We will come to that on the fourth question. It's the fourth question in the paper is to ask boards what they think, whether we should incorporate the Q&As into the IFRS for SMEs, whether we should maintain them separately or whether we should deal with them in education material.
But that is that decision dependent on how we vote on the first questions?
No. I think maybe we could deal with whether you're happy with a two-tier system first and then maybe come to those afterwards.
Okay.
And deal with them.
So are we happy with a two-tier system?
So what does two-tier system mean? So in the future, if there is a significant or important issue, so the tier one issue will brought to effect.
It will go through the full due process via the board, but it will be dealt with pretty much in a similar way as we're dealing with the Q&As at the moment, but it may need to be tightened up to a full approval rather than a negative approval. But those will be the rare case. But for the majority of the Q&As, we expect them to drop down to just be under the approval of the SME implementation group.
And be issued as educational
material,
not Q&As.
The solution will be developed by the group, but ratified by the whole board.
But it would have to go through a board approval, authoritative guidance, yeah. But that would be the rare case.
Because in essence, what we're doing is a tier one Q&A is effectively changing the standard, either through a formal interpretation, because it's binding, it's mandatory. So it's actually changing the standard that we've originally approved. Whereas a tier two one is simply providing guidance.
Okay, so we have already decided we want to continue with the Q&A program. Now the question is, do we want to continue with two-tier system? Any objections? No objections. Next question.
Well, there's two parts to the question. There's the first is whether or not the staff and the SME implementation group think that the ISB should establish a procedure for constituents to submit issues to the SME implementation group via the ISB website. And we said we would do this in the terms of conditions of the SME implementation group, but it hasn't been set up yet. The staff are proposing to manage expectations that the issues are not posted online, and instead we say we'll deal with them as a matter of course as part of the IFRS Foundation education material, and only significant issues that come out of that would be forwarded to the SME implementation group for their consideration, so those meeting the three criteria in the terms of operation of the SME implementation group. It's whether the ISB agree with the staff that that should be process should be set up.
Sure. Yeah. So, Michelle, Can you tell me, in terms of his proposal in paragraph 27D, should the SME implementation group have a process to respond to minor issues and provide informal guidance? That set off alarm bells for me. It wasn't clear to me whether we were suggesting that the SME group would do that or would not do that.
27D, where's that?
27D, suggested improvements to the Q&A program, paragraph 27D.
Not in the terms of conditions or in the...
Page 16. Second sentence on D.
The SME should have a process where it can respond to more minor issues and provide guidance in an informal way outside the Q&A process.
That was one of the comments in the comment letters. Yes.
Yeah, I wasn't sure whether how that related to this submit issues, etc., that you were talking about.
Well, those kind of issues will come to us via the website, but those kind of issues really should be ones that are dealt with in the education material produced by the Education Initiative.
Yeah.
And it would only be the major issues, because the issues sent to the SME implementation group would obviously want to be limited to those major issues.
We have a technical inquiries policy,
yeah.
And that is we don't respond and provide a technical inquiry service. And by capturing these inquiries through this website, we'll actually get more control over this whole process, I think. So that's I don't think there's... You know, the only wording in here was it was a respondent suggested that the SMEG should have rather than...
It just wasn't clear to me whether we were suggesting that we move forward to achieve this or to not achieve this. And you're saying... We would not achieve this.
We don't have plans to set up a technical inquiries policy for SMEs.
Gary?
I support the two-tier, and if you look at question three, should we establish a procedure to submit issues? And it was sort of binary. What's your alternative? We don't establish a procedure for the SMEG to get these things. It seems like the question self-answers itself.
Well, we have been getting issues anyway. We've had more than enough to deal with without setting this up, which is why we haven't set it up already. But this was something that we said we would do all along.
I'd like to put a little structure into how it occurs and something more than a process question.
Right. On the way, sir. Agreed? Yes.
Well, the final question is how should we deal with the current Q&As? So the seven existing Q&As, should they be deleted and should we look to incorporate them in the R4S SMEs? By doing so, anything we incorporate would become mandatory. At the moment, these Q&As are non-mandatory. Or should we continue to maintain these separately as non-mandatory guidance?
Well, if any of them were important enough that we should change the thing, then you should bring a proposal that we should change the thing. But otherwise, leave them as they are.
And would they be brought down to tier two, I guess, is another.
Yeah. Yeah. Have you done the analysis, you know, the nature of those?
Yeah, she's bringing, may I, before you, it's the question itself, it's a little bit odd, because then when we go to the Q&A, the seven ones, you identify some that could be easily incorporated and are subject to future board papers or we've been discussing already, and some you suggest. So it's difficult to simply respond this question saying yes or no, right? Because you yourself is bringing in separate board papers. So, so I would suggest we do not respond this generally, but then consider as you are suggesting here.
I think the question more is, I agree there's bound to be issues that arise that we are going to want to incorporate in the IFRS for SMEs, and probably really more the issue is for those Q&As that we don't incorporate, should we maintain them separately or should we...
So the question would be, why not maintain? Because if I go to one here that you consider too detailed to incorporate, jurisdiction requires fallback to full IFRS. So... I agree with you, but why not keep it?
Or are you suggesting put into education? If we create a second tier, just put it into an education.
They're already, in the last few months, we have already incorporated them into the education initiative training material on the SME, and it's whether or not we still, after deciding which bits were appropriate in the IFRS for SMEs, whether we should still continue to maintain them separately as a separate guidance, or whether we do want to look to eliminate those into an education material.
I'd say I think we should, if we should try to incorporate them. If we decide it's not appropriate to incorporate them, then I think we should incorporate them into the educational material, but not maintain them as a separate supplemental stream of information about the SME standard. I think we should be able to say to the world, it's one standalone document, and there's educational material to support it. And that's what we've got.
Yeah.
I agree. Agreed?
Yes.
Yeah.
16 agree.
Will there always be like this period of time before we get to that status that Mary just described where you put out the Q&A? Do you actually go through a formal step to say it's now going into education material, or is it just de facto considered to be there? If it's not incorporated into the formal standard, and is there like this limbo?
I assume at the
because you're putting papers in to discuss whether stuff should be incorporated, aren't you?
Yeah, they have already all been incorporated in the training material.
Okay.
All the Q&As have, but that'll be something going forward.
Okay. So we've done. Is it me or is it incredibly hot here?
Yeah.